Hello and welcome to KAC Online. For those of you who don't know, my name is Danielle Johnson and I'm on staff here at Kamloops Alliance Church, but I am still on mat leave. But mat leave happens to be coming to an end at the end of summer, which is bittersweet for me. And I am, in many respects, very excited about coming back to work. I love this church, I love ministry, but at the same time, mat leave has just been a sweet season for me with my girl. And so we are just, as a family, squeezing everything that we can out of this final summer month. But I'm excited about being here. I'm excited about the word that God has for us. We're in a series called Psalms, Meeting Jesus in Every Season of Life. And today we're going to be looking at Psalm 127. And we're going to be looking at how our parenting approach is a means to encountering God. And so what I want to do is I want to read the passage for us. I want to pray, and then I just want to dive right in. So wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, if you have your Bibles with you, I'm going to ask that you would turn to Psalm 127 with me. We're going to read all five verses. Okay, unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for he grants sleep to those he loves. Children are a heritage from the Lord, offspring a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their opponents in court. Lord, I thank you for your word, and I thank you that it is a sweet invitation for us to come and meet with you. And so in this time, wherever we're sitting, Lord, would you come by your Spirit and just reveal more about who you are and who and how we are called to be and parent in light of it. We ask this all in your name. Amen. So it is, I might be slightly biased, but I don't think it's ever been more more confusing to be a parent. Everybody's written a book. Everybody's posting online. There's more information available to you and I, and most of it is contradictory. So in any given day, these are some of the messages that you and I can receive as parents. Babies should sleep on their tummies, but also babies should sleep on their backs. You can rock your baby to sleep, but also don't rock your baby to sleep unless you want to continue doing so once your child is in college. Hey, you should definitely give your child lots of praise, but also don't praise your child too much as it can undermine their desire to behave well for their own sake. Treat your teenager with the respect you would give a friend, but also your teenager is not your friend and you are the boss. Set rules for your children, but be willing to compromise on occasion, but also make sure those rules are always followed. And also, don't punish children when they misbehave, but when children misbehave, they should also experience the negative consequences of their actions. It is confusing to be a parent. And then you add in the digital age, things like the internet, social media, and cell phones, and it's dramatically changed the parenting landscape. Once upon a time, all you had to do was make sure that your kids were clothed, fed, and clean behind the ears, and now you need to talk about media use with your five-year-old because they can use your iPad better than you. And it's a good thing because your child needs to be coding before they're two, they need to speak Mandarin before they're five, and they need to have a complete LinkedIn profile before they are 10. It's confusing to be a parent. And so for you, you would describe parenting much like feeling your way around in a dark room, except for that dark room also is filled with monkeys. It's scary, it's uncertain, and it looks and smells a lot like a zoo. And none of it feels like encountering Jesus. And so I believe that this sermon is good news for you, no matter where you find yourself in the parenting journey. I believe that this sermon is good news for the parents who have just recently welcomed a sweet little baby into the world. You've read every book you could get your hands on, you've listened to every podcast, and on the outset, this little baby looks rather harmless, but in actuality, it stirs more fear in you than you are willing to admit. I believe this sermon is good news for the parents of young children who are certain their kids have plotted together to make their days particularly difficult. You say and do embarrassing things, you raise your voice and make ominous threats, but nothing seems to help. You feel like you've lost control of your own house, and silently and with a little bit of guilt, you wish for the simplicity of what life was like before kids. This sermon is good news for the parents of teenagers who look back with fondness at the times their kids used to hold their hands in public and run into their arms after school, and now they barely acknowledge your existence. They seem embarrassed by you, and as much as you hate to admit it, it hurts a little. And you laugh it off like it's just a phase, but inside you're terrified your kids are slipping through your fingers. The sermon is good news for the parents whose children are making decisions that run so contrary to your family values. You're heartbroken and confused, and you lie awake at night wondering where you went wrong, and you're so uncertain about what boundaries to hold and where to even place them. This sermon is good news for the empty nesters who have recently welcomed their adult child back home while they look for a job, and you have mixed emotions. You loved having your house and your time back, but you missed being a parent, and now they're back and it's different. You know they still need you, but they certainly don't act like it. And every night you try to go to bed at your usual time, but you never really get to sleep until you hear them walk in through the front door. You're tired of being a parent and thankful to have your kids home all at the same time. Oh, this sermon is good news for the parents who are having the types of conversations with their kids you are certain you had at least another couple of years to prepare for. And you consider yourself a fairly eloquent person, but you weren't able to string two coherent sentences together just then. You splutter your way through your answers in what felt like a watershed moment with your child, and you are hoping and you are praying that you didn't mess it up. This sermon is good news for the grandparents who have years of child rearing behind them and now wonder what role they continue to play in the lives of their family. Now, with years of retirement and an influx of disposable income, you've got two decisions to make. Do you spend all of your time wintering in Arizona and summering on the Shuswap, or do you spend parts of your golden years being available for those conversations in the car during school pickups, sitting in the audience for yet another piano recital, and being available for those loud, chaotic family dinners you thought you had finally washed your hands of? This sermon is good news for the couple whose hearts ache for children, and after numerous years of trying, you're beginning to wonder why everyone else seems to be pregnant but you. And before you tune out because you don't fall into any of these categories and none of this applies to you, this sermon is good news for you, church family, because if you've been part of KC for any length of time, you've been witness to baby dedications where overtired parents have stood on this stage and said, I cannot do this thing on my own. We cannot do this thing on our own. And we as a church family have stood together and we vowed that we would rally around these kids as spiritual aunts and uncles, mentors, leaders, and to point these kids, to champion them to Jesus, because God has not just entrusted these kids to these parents, but He's entrusted them to us. This sermon is good news. And so if our parenting approach is meant to be a means to encountering God, and it isn't, the question for you and I is why? See, our parenting approach is shaped by the culture that we live in, our cultural values, and all our culture values progress and individualism and success. And so it's no wonder that our parenting approach has followed suit. Cornell researchers polled 3,600 parents, and they found in this study that across socioeconomic backgrounds, moms and dads believe that the best parenting approach is what they call intensive parenting. And Cornell researchers define intensive parenting as a parenting approach that's child-centered, money and time intensive, and expert-led. And so we are parenting in a time where internal and external pressures are at an all-time high. Everybody's written a book. Everybody has advice. We have unrealistic societal expectations, and we are obsessed with the idea of successful parenting. And all of that combined has caused you and I to bear a burden in our parenting that we were never meant to. And it makes sense. What do you do when internal and external pressures are high? You double down. A number of years ago, I was invited to a dip competition. And by dip, I mean like spinach dip, 7-layer dip. And if you know anything about me, you know that when I hear the word competition in a sentence, it awakens a part of me that I'm not particularly proud of, but must win at all costs. And so I start strategizing immediately. And my mom has a recipe for a bean dip that some of you have had and can attest to the fact that it is good. And so I think I've got this thing in the bank. And I start getting a little bit cocky. I start talking this bean dip up. And so now not only are internal pressures high, but external pressures are high. Now I have my own reputation as a dip connoisseur to uphold. I have my own mother's honor to uphold. I have a whole legacy to fight for. And so with internal and external pressures high, I double down. I start making this dip like everything rides on it. I start buying the best ingredients. I start grating cheese like it's a lost art form, because for me, everything is riding on this Corning ware of goop. And I didn't win, and I called foul, because the person who won didn't just make the dip, they made the dipper, they made a homemade pretzel, and I didn't know that it was fair game to not just make the dip, you could also make the dipper, but that's not the point. The moral of the story is that when internal and external pressures are high, you double down. And so the onslaught of expert advice and unrealistic societal expectations and our modern obsession with successful parenting has caused you and I to take a parenting approach that Paul David Tripp says is ownership parenting. And ownership parenting says, these children are mine, their thriving is my responsibility, and therefore I can and I should parent them however I see fit. Ownership parenting is motivated by what parents want for their children and from their children. It's driven by a vision of who we want our children to be and what we want from them in return. And I don't believe that any parent has said this outright. I don't think any parent of any value has said this outright. That's the thing about parenting. Parenting doesn't just happen in the big, grandiose moments where you are engaged and checked in. It also happens in the little, unplanned moments that are so small and so mundane that they go completely unnoticed. And when our parenting approach remains unchecked and it's shaped by cultural ideals and cultural values, it slowly drifts away from God's design. And it's not that what we want for our kids is necessarily bad things. It's good to want your kids to excel. It's good to want your kids to thrive. But what ownership parenting does is it places a burden on us, and it places a burden on our children that neither of us were meant to carry. Paul David Tripp says this. He says, ownership parenting is not overtly selfish, abusive, or destructive. It involves a subtle shift in thinking and motivation that puts us on a trajectory that leads our parenting far away from God's design. And so if ownership parenting isn't God's design, the question for us is, well, what is? And I think we find it in Psalm 127. Psalm 127 is a song of ascent. It's a poem written as a worship song to be sung at the birth of every Jewish baby and to sung by pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem. It's a celebration of who God is and how we are called to parent in light of it. It is an ancient parenting manifesto that butts up against the modern parenting paradigm and invites us to encounter Jesus in our parenting in the big, grandiose moments and in those little, unplanned moments. And so what I want to do for the next little bit is just walk through the passage and see what we encounter about God in our parenting, pulling each verse out line by line. So if you have your Bibles, I'm going to ask you just to follow along with me, line, underline, whatever you got to do. So we'll start in verse 1. Verse 1, the author says, unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. The word house here. The Hebrew word for the word house is used in a bit of a cheeky wordplay where it's given two meanings, and it's lost in our modern day English, but translators would tell us that the Hebrew word for house can be translated either as dwelling or to family. The second thing I want us to see is that the author has organized the work, the effort that he's talking about in this passage, into two categories. One, we've got building and creating, or two, preserving and protecting. And so when the author is talking about building and preserving, he's not talking about constructing a literal building or protecting a literal city. He's also talking about creating and preserving a family. And creating and preserving are really the two pillars of parenting, right? Everything we do as parents is to create and preserve our children. And then Psalm 127 comes in and says, well, actually, it's the Lord that builds the house. It's the Lord that builds our family. It's the Lord that watches over our family. That unless the Lord builds, the builders labor in vain. And unless the Lord watches, the guards stand watch in vain. And these builders and these guards are you and I. They're you and I as parents and grandparents, spiritual aunts and uncles, mentors and leaders. And it says that unless the Lord builds and protects, every ounce of effort that you and I exert to construct and protect, build and preserve is sideways energy. It's useless. And this is a personal affront to the ownership approach of to parenting, because Psalm 127 says you cannot do it apart from God. He is the decisive builder, the decisive preserver in your children's lives. And this is where we encounter the beauty and the mystery of God's sovereignty in our parenting. And it's not that God is deciding whether or not he wants to build or he wants to watch. God is always in the business of acting and intervening in the lives of those he loves. Is that you and I have a choice to make. We can parent in alignment with his plans, or we can parent in alignment with ours. And this is so hard because we think we know what's best for our children. And so we quote Jeremiah 29:11, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to keep you and not to harm you, to give you hope and a future. We quote it at baby showers and baby dedications. And then in those little unplanned moments of parenting, we take the reins back. These children are mine. Their thriving is my responsibility. And therefore I can and I should parent them however I see fit. And so we can get up and arms about Psalm 127, or we can see what it's inviting us into. When I was a little girl, my parents had a tandem bike for me that I could use on family bike rides. And in many respects, my tandem bike looked a lot like a regular bike. It had handlebars and working pedals and a little back tire that spun. But the difference between my tandem bike and a regular bike is that instead of a front wheel, it had a piece that connected to my dad's so that he could lead the way and I could ride in alignment with him. And at the ripe age of 3, I could have said, you know what, Dad, this bike is mine. Pretty sure this ride was my idea. And so I think I'm going to cycle however I see fit. And I could have jumped off my bike, disconnected it from his, got back on board, tried to steer the handlebars, pedaled my little heart out, and I wouldn't have gotten anywhere. And instead, what I was invited to do was to remain connected to my dad, to allow him to do the steering, to allow him to do the majority of the pedaling. But in doing so, I had to acknowledge that as the stronger, far more capable one, he should be leading the way. And this is the invitation of Psalm 127. God is the decisive builder, the decisive protector in your children's lives. And in that beauty and mystery of God's sovereignty and our human responsibility, he invites us to come and to connect ourselves to him, to parent in alignment with his will. But in doing so, we need to acknowledge that as King of the universe, he should be leading the way. All right, moving on. Psalm 127:2 says, in vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for he grants sleep to those he loves. In this passage, the rising early and the staying up late is not the issue, it's the toiling. And toiling is what you and I do when internal and external pressures are high, when the onslaught of expert advice and unrealistic expectations, our obsession with getting it right, makes us feel like everything is riding on our shoulders. And then Psalm 127 comes in and says, oh no, the Lord grants sleep to those he loves. And this is where we encounter God's grace in our parenting. Because God doesn't give us a task without giving us everything we need to do it. He doesn't send us without also promising to go with us. And the best part about this is that he grants sleep to those he loves. God's heart for you is rest because he loves you. He loves you. And if you need proof, you look at the cross. Romans 8 says, he did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. How will he not also, along with him, graciously give us everything, all things? See, God sent his son to die on the cross so that we could live life in connection with him, so we could parent in alignment with his will. Why would he not give us everything we need to live the life that he purchased for us? Why would he not also give us everything we need to live the life that he purchased for us? And so it's God's sovereignty that proves to us that he should be leading the way. He's the decisive builder, the decisive protector, but it's his love for us and his love for our children that proves that he should be leading the way. Verse 3 says, children are a heritage from the Lord, offspring, a reward from him. Children are a heritage and a reward. See, the Lord builds, and when he builds, his creations are always good. And this is where we encounter the goodness of God in our parenting. Pew Research did a study, and they found that 44% of non-parenting adults say they are not too likely or not at all likely to have children. And I know that this is a complex topic, but the majority of those respondents said they were not at all likely or not too likely to have children simply because they just don't want to. Why? I think that's in part due to the modern notion that children are a drain on our limited resources. Children are expensive. Children are time consuming. Children are a burden. And then Psalm 127 comes in and says, oh no, children are a heritage. Children are a reward. They're good because He is good. I didn't have kids till I was 33 years old, and there's many factors at play there. But if I'm honest, one of the reasons is that I saw having children as a threat to my career, to my freedom, to my productivity. And then I had a child and I learned that all of that is true. This little baby did in fact infringe on everything I felt entitled to, and it has been, and it is, and I'm certain that it will continue to be hard, but I am learning that raising this little girl is a front row seat to the goodness of God. She is good because He is good. His plans for her are good because He is good. When the Lord builds His buildings, His creations are always good. Verses 4 and 5 say, like arrows in the hands of a warrior, children born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their opponents in court. What? This phrase here, contend with their opponents in court, is worded in other translations as speaks with his enemies at the gate. In the ancient Near East, the gate served as a combined town hall and courtroom. It was a place where people gathered. It was a place where decisions were made and justice was administered. And so if we draw out the application here, the author is saying that one day your kids will stand as a witness. They will stand as a testament of who you are, and their lives, their little lives, will be like arrows, rendering anyone's testimony against you ineffective. You will not be put to shame. So not only does the Lord build, and His buildings are always good, but the Lord protects, and His protection is always good. It's God's sovereignty that proves that He should be leading the way. It's His love for us that proves that He will lead the way. And it's His goodness that proves that His ways are always better than ours. So what does this look like practically? How do we parent in light of God's sovereignty, His grace, and His goodness? I believe that Psalm 127 calls us to move from parenting as ownership to parenting as ambassadorship. And the only thing that an ambassador needs to do is faithfully represent the message, the character, and the method of the one who sent them. Your job as a parent is to fan the flame of your child's heart for Jesus, to stoke the coals, to present Jesus as beautiful and as compelling as He is. And you do so by faithfully representing the message, character, and methods of Jesus. And so in the short little amount of time that we have left, I want to talk about what that looks like in our parenting. And I want to acknowledge that these are big topics, and I am not even going to skim the surface. And so I hope that one day we get the chance to take a deeper dive. But what does it look like for us to represent the message of Jesus in our parenting? You probably have family stories. Stories are good, they're powerful, but the dominant story that we need to be telling in our homes and in our families is the message of Jesus. And Jesus's message was that He came to bring life, and He came to bring it in the full. And He does so by inviting us into deep, intimate, rich relationship with Him because He loves us. And this is the message that needs to resound in your children's ears. And you can do that by saying those exact words. Jesus came to bring life, and He came to bring it in the full. And that's good, and that's important, and we need to do that. But we also need to be talking about the ways that He's doing so, the ways that God is producing life in you and through you. And so you can talk about the big, grandiose moments where you gave your life to Jesus or you were baptized. But we can also talk about it in those little mundane moments where God is coming and He's teaching you more about His mercy as you ask a coworker for forgiveness, or how Jesus makes you feel safe when you're scared, or you're learning more about His love in your prayer time. Because not only was Jesus' message that He came to bring life, but He also lived it out. Everything that Jesus did was about producing life. And the thing is that you and I are meant to become like Jesus. And that's a tough pill to swallow, because if you've read this book, you'll see that Jesus has more love, hope, joy, goodness, kindness, compassion, and patience in His little finger than all of us do in our entire bodies. And the good news and the bad news is that the crucible of parenthood is one way that we are formed into the image of Christ. And the crucible of parenthood is one way, one reason why we are formed into the image of Christ. No one needs us to look and act more like Jesus than our own families. And so you weren't given kids to make you happy. You were given kids to make you holy so that you would think and act like Jesus more today than you did yesterday. So that the life that Jesus came to bring would be the natural outflow of your life so that you would become an agent of life in your own household. And so we don't grit our teeth and try to look like Jesus. Jesus has given us the method, the means. Not only was his message that he came to bring life, not only did he live it out, but he demonstrated the means for us. Jesus was a man of presence and prayer. He was always drawing a way to be with the Father, to commune with him in prayer. And he did so because his life and his ministry necessitated it. He received everything he needed in that time. And so it is with us. The calling over our lives as parents necessitates that we be people of presence in prayer, because in that time we receive everything we need for the life that we've been called to. Because in those times we receive everything we need for parenthood. In those times we tune our senses to the presence of God so that in the little unplanned moments we can hear his voice and perceive his presence, so that over time, and it's a lifelong journey, you and I learn to be in two places at once, rocking the baby to sleep and in the presence of God, helping your kid with their calculus homework and in the presence of God, having a difficult conversation with your 18-year-old and in the presence of God. And two, in that time, we also contend for the decisive actions of God in our lives. We commit our children over again, and we contend for the decisive actions of God in their lives. When I was a little girl, I used to wake up in the middle of the night to my mom praying for me. And as a child, it was 10 out of 10 weird, but it was also so formative because it showed me that my mom didn't think she could do it on her own, that she could not do it apart from God, and that it was his sovereignty that proved to her that he should be leading the way. It was his love for her and his love for me that proved that he would lead the way, and it was his goodness. It was his goodness that proved that his ways were always better than ours. And here's the last thing I want to say on the topic. Psalm 127 is a song of ascent. It's a poem written as a worship song to be sung at the birth of every Jewish baby, to be sung by groups of people on pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so there is a personal aspect to this poem, but there's also a communal aspect. And I believe it is an acute reminder for you and I of the communal aspect of parenting, that children aren't just raised in the home, that the church plays a pivotal role in shaping our children's lives. Kerry Newhoff, in his book, Parenting Beyond Your Capacity, uses the color orange as a metaphor to describe what happens when you combine two influences. So like the color orange is a secondary color that's made up of two primary colors, red and yellow. And he encourages us to think about parenting in the same way, that it's the outcome of two combined influences, the home and the church. And hear me say this, this is not I drop my kids off at youth or my kids attend KAC Kids every Sunday. This is you being fully engaged in the life-giving actions of the church, because not only do your kids need to be engaged, but they need to see you engaged, where you serve others and others serve you, because in this place is where they see the gospel on display. They see the unity and the mission of the church. They gain a sense of belonging, and they get to hear truth articulated by people other than you. And you may be able to do this thing on your own right now, but a time will come when you need the support and encouragement of a community that is so for you and so for your children. And as a person who has experienced the support and encouragement of a community that is for me, my biggest advice to you is to build that community before you need it. To surround your children with those voices before you need it. And this is my last spicy rant. If the church plays a pivotal role in shaping our children's lives, then KAC Kids is not a peripheral ministry. It is central to who we are. And for whatever reason, churches everywhere have a difficult time securing kids volunteers. And I don't know if it's because it's perceived to be more behind the scenes, or it's that modern notion that kids are just a pain in the butt. But I will say it again, Psalm 127 says children are a heritage, they are a reward. And in that beauty and mystery of God's sovereignty and our human responsibility, has called us to partner with him to play a role in shaping these children's lives. And so if you call KAC home, can I encourage you, and you're like, I don't know, I want to get involved, but I don't know where, can I encourage you to consider KAC Kids? And if you would even like to explore it, you can reach out to Pastor Carlene at carlene@countlessalliance.com, or you can just go on our website and fill out the serve form at countlessalliance.com/serve. Okay. For decades, researchers, psychologists, educators, and sociologists have promoted the power and the value of the family meal. Children who enjoy a regular family meal do better in school, they do better with their peers. Why? Because when you gather around the family meal, more than just empty stomachs are filled. Around the family meal, as you talk about your day and what's going on in your lives, a child's most fundamental need for connection is met. And so today, as we transition into communion, I want us to think about the communion as just that, the family meal. Yes, there is a personal aspect to communion where you and I sit personally and reflect on what the death and resurrection of Jesus means for our lives. But there's also a communal aspect, and I acknowledge that that's kind of lost online when we're gathering in our own respective places. And I believe that the symbolism is most relevant when we gather together as a community. But I think to some extent the principle still applies, because although we are in our own respective houses, we are united in spirit. And so when we come and we observe the family supper, we confess together that we are sinners and we are needy. And then we proclaim together the gospel that restores us back into deep, vibrant relationship with God. That in the body broken, in Jesus' body, broken body and his blood shed, is where our most fundamental need for connection with God is met. And then we witness Jesus in our midst, who hasn't come necessarily to fill empty stomachs, but to feed hungry souls. So in 1 Corinthians 11, Pastor Paul says, "The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" See, it's the body of Christ broken for you. It's his blood shed for you. I invite you to take the elements now.